This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from Arizona Highways. This article is entitled Executive Order 9066. During World War II, Arizona was home to two internment camps. Although President Roosevelt signed the order, his wife disapproved, especially after a visit to the Gila River camp. The USS Arizona was sunk in the attack on Pearl Harbor. It was the first of two historic World War II events linked to the Grand Canyon State. The second began in February 1942. That's when President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066, which ordered people of Japanese descent living in the western United States to report to relocation centers, better known as internment camps. Arizona was home to two such camps, Gila River Relocation Center and Poston Relocation Center. The Gila River camps, Butte and Canal, opened in July 1942, and even though the center was originally scheduled to hold 10,000 residents, the 15,000-acre camp eventually became home to more than 13,000 people of Japanese descent, and they stayed for 3 years. A 1942 Arizona Republic story described the camp as Arizona's fourth largest city. Gila River's infrastructure included schools, hospitals, flower gardens, ball fields, and even a gymnasium and auditorium built by the residents. Japanese farmers at Gila River maintained large vegetable gardens, and out of necessity, the residents raised cattle, hogs, and chickens. This farm provided not only the Gila River mess hall with fresh vegetables, milk, eggs, and meat, but food was sent to other relocation camps as well. Gila River was said to be the most relaxed of all the camps. Some even described it as a show place, which is why President Roosevelt sent First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt there in April 1943 to check on conditions and report back. The president wanted to know if the detainees were indeed living like kings, as some had suggested. According to his wife, they were not. In an essay for Collier's magazine following her visit, Mrs. Roosevelt explained that conditions were far from ideal, noting the desert dust as one of the worst hardships, she wrote. This makes a high wind a pretty disagreeable experience as you are enveloped in dust. It chokes you and brings about irritations of the nose and throat. On the day I was at Gila, there was no butter and no sugar on the tables. The food was rice and fish and greens. Neither in the stock rooms nor on the tables did I notice any kind of extravagance. Camp problems included chronic water shortages, overcrowding, and heat and cooling issues. The First Lady had been against the idea of Japanese internment from the beginning, and what she witnessed at Gila River reinforced that opinion. To undo a mistake is always harder than not to create one originally, she wrote, but we seldom have the foresight. And this concludes Executive Order 9066. Leah Duren is the author of Puff Daddy. Chuck Wallace are colorful, but even more impressive is their ability to inflate with air to fend off predators. Chuck Wallace are big and brightly colored, but these shy and elusive lizards are hard to find without patience and a good pair of binoculars. They're even harder to catch. When Chuck Wallace feel threatened, they wedge themselves into the nearest rock crevice by inflating with air, making it difficult for predators to extract them. This self-defense mechanism, however, was no match for the Shoshones, Paiutes, and other Indians who liked to eat Chuck Wallace. Using pointed sticks, they'd deflate the swollen lizards, pull them out of the rocks, and serve them for dinner. As the largest native iguanid in the United States, Chuck Wallace range from 11 to 16 and a half inches in length. They would have made a hearty meal. They're colorful, too. For example, the male Chuck Wallace on Phoenix's South Mountain boast black bodies with vibrant carrot-orange tails, a trait exclusive to this location. The bright color attracts females and comes from the intermingled red and yellow pigments found in the plants they eat, Ocotillo, desert lavender, and little leaf Palo Verde. Chuck Wallace, living south of the Salt and Gila Rivers, have the same black bodies as the South Mountain species, but their tails are yellow. To the north, the Glen Canyon population near Page features a tricolor pattern, black head and limbs, a yellowish-white tail, and orange bands around the torso. Although chuckwallas are no longer threatened by Indians, they're now being hunted by collectors looking to sell them as pets. The chuckwallas in South Mountain are especially desired for the distinctive coloring. What's more, public access to their habitat creates greater vulnerability. The Arizona Game and Fish Department banned the removal of South Mountain chuckwallas in 1997, but illegal collecting continues. Resting the lizards from their hideouts not only threatens the chuckwallas, but it also causes habitat destruction, says Dr. Matthew Kiewatowski, an associate professor of biology at Stephen F. Austin State University in Texas, who studied chuckwallas in Arizona. What people will do is take a crowbar and pry the crevice open and tear up the rock, he says. Turns out these rock crevices aren't all the same. Some are good for chuckwallas because they have the right temperature or a little higher humidity. Adding to the threat is the fact that chuckwallas, which can live up to 20 years in captivity, produce limited offspring. In dry years, when food is scarce, females won't reproduce at all, Kiewatowski says. The South Mountain chuckwalla is a unique biological treasure, he says, and like any treasure, you'll want to protect it. And this concludes Puff Daddy. Kathleen Walker is the author of King of the Roads. Norman Wallace worked on railroads, bridges, and highways, including Route 66 and the Black Canyon Highway. That was his day job. For the heck of it, he took photographs, thousands and thousands of photographs. Forests, canyons, missions, caves, ancient ruins. He shot just about everything. And along the way, he built an amazing legacy of art and history. A good road can be a thing of beauty when you've got someplace to go. And who wouldn't discount the value of a bridge when you've got something to cross? But to see the world the way Norman Wallace saw it, to travel from pre-revolution Mexico to Arizona, well, that's a trip. In 1999, the Arizona History Museum in Tucson began the process required to make the Wallace collection available to researchers. What they found in the 41 boxes of 5,000 images, albums, prints, and negatives was a treasure. Black and white might predominate, but the glow given off by this collection is pure gold. It is a major collection, says Reva Dean, archives director of the museum. What's more, the majority of these photos have never been seen before. He had a really good eye, Dean says, so aesthetically, they're really amazing photographs. Wallace, who was born in Ohio, arrived in Tucson in 1906, 20 years old and handsome as a movie star cowboy. He'd come west to work for the Southern Pacific, building railroads in Mexico, and he brought a friend along for the ride. I had a little bit of a camera, he recalled almost 70 years later. I think they call it 4A, a Kodak box camera. One camera or another would be by his side for the next 40 years. He moved from railroading to bridge building to mining from Mexico to Arizona. In 1932, he joined the Arizona Highway Department and spent the next 23 years surveying and plotting the routes of new highways. If you've ever driven in Arizona, you know his work. He was the engineer who carved the way. His first assignment was on a little strip of road across northern Arizona, which would later roll into the legendary Route 66. He also did the location work for the Black Canyon Highway, which runs from Phoenix to Flagstaff. He later described it as some of my hardest work. The job began in 1945. He was 60 years old. I walked from the Arizona Canal in North Phoenix to Flagstaff twice, he recalled in a 1975 interview. Somebody had to find out where that road was going. He also was well acquainted with the early years of State Route 84, which then ran from Tucson to Gila Bend, former U.S. Route 70 from Globe to the New Mexico Line, U.S. Route 89 up Mingus Mountain, and old U.S. Route 80, now State Route 80, running north of Bisbee. He knew a time when mule teams were still being used to build those roads, and he took the pictures. He photographed the pastoral scenes of early 1900s Mexico, then the horrors of revolution that followed. He captured the towns and land of Arizona before statehood. Forests, canyons, Spanish missions, caves, ancient ruins, all were fodder for his camera. As were the bridges, the dams, and the roads, always the roads. In 1968, Wallace turned over an estimated 2,000 of his images to the Arizona Highway Department. Following his death in 1983 at the age of 98, his wife, Henrietta, gave an additional 3,000 images to the Arizona History Museum in Tucson. The collection remained split until 1999 when the Arizona Highway Department donated its portion to the museum. Now, along with the historians, the general public can access the complete collection simply by walking through the doors of the museum's reference library. Just like that, they can travel with Wallace to the Tucson of 1910, the Mission of San Javier, the lush Sabino Canyon. They can visit the cowboys of 1913 Mexico. That same year, followers of Pancho Villa lined up in Nogales for their own photographic experience with Wallace. In the heady spirit of revolution, they had just finished looting a store. Wallace's study of the building of Route 66 might cause some researchers to break out in song. In his rendition, the kicks come from going west to east, from Topak to Kingman to the junction of U.S. 89. The roads have yet to be built in other photographs, but Wallace had marked their future routes on the images. I think it is an important collection because it shows the growth of Arizona, 20th century Arizona, Dean says. But beyond the growth, the roads and the bridges, Wallace saw something else. Most days he would turn his camera toward the land, the beauty of nature that reduced those paved roads of modern life to insignificance. And with the heart of a true photographer, Norman G. Wallace admired the view. And this concludes King of the Roads. Craig Childs is the author of Ancient Creeks. There are some obvious reasons to go backpacking in the Aravaipa Canyon Wilderness. Spectacular scenery, perennial streams, rare wildlife, peace and quiet. Less obvious is the water itself, which according to radiocarbon tests is up to 15,000 years old. Chances are it dates back to the last ice age when ancient water was stored deep within the rocky cores of the mountains. No wonder our writer was in no hurry to get back to civilization. Quiet conversations of water moved through a forest. Words chattered across smooth black stones as a clear stream turned one way and then another, threading among jail bars of tree roots. When the sun reached through a canopy of sycamores and alders, light etched the water, igniting stones at the bottom of the stream. Aravaipa Creek is famous for scenes like this, but this was not Aravaipa. It was one of Aravaipa's numerous sisters, a small creek flowing out of the Galiuro Mountains in southeast Arizona, its water eventually bound for Aravaipa itself. This is one of the nameless places, overgrown and heaped with boulders. I walked along the stream with my young son, Jasper. He held my finger firmly, not yet comfortable walking on his own. He used his other hand to part grass in front of him. My wife and our friend had gone ahead to scout a side canyon in search of roots. Waiting for their return, Jasper and I strolled along the stream, following bends of moss and cobbles. I crouched under fallen lances of alder trees, twisting around to keep my finger available as Jasper led me through green shade and toward the mumble of water. Places like this are secret and untroubled, like bits of legend scattered across the desert. Each of the Sky Island mountain ranges in southeast Arizona, like the Galiuros, lets out veins of streams, allowing life to flourish. A radiocarbon test of some of this water revealed that it could be 15,000 years old. It's probably left over from the last ice age, ancient water stored deep within the rocky cores of mountains, slowly bubbling up into daylight. My son and I passed beneath mansions of sycamore trees, their leaves as big as hands. Branches of the larger trees cover half an acre of ground, fleshy bark knobbled with orifices, folds of wood and bark that look like ears and nostrils, like fat-skinned wrinkles. Wild grapevines coil up the trunks and hang from branches. Life piled on life, a single organism of forest. Even alder trees toppled by floods had sprouted again, their branches turning vertical, sending leaves toward the meager skylight and roots down through cobbles below, unable to resist another chance at living. For variety, I turned us away from the stream. We followed a spur of a side drainage, its cobblestones damp with moss. Dark troops of oak trees gathered around us. We slowly rose into a field of cliffs, a huge canyon surrounding us, its walls weeping with springs. I hitched Jasper onto my side and climbed a little higher, reaching for holds through ferns and moss. "Hold tight," I said, and I felt Jasper's arms instantly pinch at my side, his little shoes digging like spurs into my waist. Now we were in the forest canopy, edgewise to the half-acre branches, able to see birds as they piped and warbled from their perches, a yellow breast, one dashed with green, shoulders of red. I stopped and swiped water off a rock with two fingers and brought my fingers to my lips, wondering if this was rain or snow that had fallen in Pleistocene times, my lips the first to touch it since then. Jasper leaned his head out, reaching a curious hand, waiting for me to touch his lips too. I did. He tasted spring water, fresh out of the earth, with a little grit of stone, the clean savor of ice long melted. Jasper gave me a squeeze and a high-pitched utterance, reminding me of his other needs. I pulled a strip of jerky from my pocket, chewed off its tip, and then passed a sweet plum of meat into his mouth. He took it without a response. If he felt gratitude, it showed only in the way he continued to hold on to me. I put my fingers in the spring water again and tapped them on his lips. He grinned. My small family and I had been traveling for weeks in the area, rationing diapers, staying near dependable water sources for drinking and bathing. We set camps on canyon rims and along ridges. Our friend Colin, another wilderness traveler, came along to help, knowing that travel with a baby was much more work. Later that day, we all regrouped and Colin and I set off to see what we could find. We were trying to grasp the lay of the immediate country, seeking routes that could later be traveled with a baby in tow. Colin was fast and eventually had to stop for a break. My feet were bleeding. We were wearing sandals instead of boots. Sandals prove better for making distance in this kind of country, getting in and out of water, sinking into wet sand, and climbing out the other side, but they weren't much good for protection. I sat on a shelf of rock and pulled off one of my sandals. A splinter of a twig stuck out of the soft skin of my sole. I gripped it firmly between thumb and forefinger and pulled it out, eliciting a quick barb of pain. I hunkered down to a pool of fresh water where I cupped my hands and washed my feet, rubbing dirt out of a score of minor wounds. I reached up and pinched off a leaf of lavender from a powder blue tinged plant beside me. I rubbed the leaf until it was moist in my fingers and dabbed it on the fresh red abrasion on my right foot. I was ready to go again. We found the tributaries of Aravaipa deeply incised, winding down through canyons and cliffs, restricting the number of routes. Just finding a way back to camp by dark was going to be a challenge. Colin and I reached a ridge to get a view well above the forest. High desert vegetation surrounded us. Agaves, mesquites, prickly pears, and bear grass shaded by gnarled thickets of scrub oak. From there we saw down into the next canyon, and the one past that, and one past that again. The sisters of Aravaipa are many. My heart was drumming from the scramble, breath pushing in and out. I turned and looked behind us, seeing the same as what we saw ahead, bleached heads of stone standing up from canyons. Colin and I trotted along the ridge until it gave out and embarked downward, hoping to enter the right drainage, the one that would lead toward our camp. We started running, taking advantage of the steep terrain. White-tailed deer bolted in front of us, flashing out of the brush and into sunlight. They sprinted along a slope beside us, and we kept pace with them, breaking this way and that as we sank into the shadows of a new canyon, one we thought would take us home. Cliffs rose around us, enormous passageways opening, leading us to steep and rocky routes. We moved quickly through the somber light of dusk. Gray tree frogs clung to walls around us. Their long, high song swelled into the canyon. As we neared them, each frog jettisoned like tiny cliff divers, plunking down into pools of water collected in the scoured bedrock basins below. We climbed over the basins and wedged ourselves down along a tightening corridor. There were no trails, no signs. We read the land carefully, but soon found ourselves trapped. Our canyon had funneled into a plummet with the cold black holes of water drilled into the floor. Colin took one last running leap, bounding over several of these water tanks. He spanned the last one and landed on his dry lip, teetering for a moment, peering out. "Does it go?" I asked, wondering if there was a route or if we were going to have to turn back. Colin looked straight down past the toes of his sandals, his arms stretched to both sides as he were standing on a tightrope. "Does it go?" I repeated. "Dead end," Colin said. He had vaulted his way to a thin purchase of rock over a free fall canyon. I quickly scanned up the walls around me, seeing a few ledges I could use to climb out. Colin was an accomplished climber. I'd seen him do things on rock I would have thought physically impossible. He didn't need my help. Good luck, I told him. I'll see you down below somewhere. I climbed ledge by ledge. From higher up, I glanced at Colin, still standing at an edge below me. He was taking a few breaths to consider his options. I could see now what he was faced with. Balanced on a few inches of bare stone with a pool of water as dark as onyx behind him, he was looking a couple hundred feet into empty space, the canyon dropping out from under him. Knowing he'd managed just fine, I didn't look back at him again. After about 10 minutes of inching around wall after wall, I found a slope of rock rubble. I skittered into a narrow crevice, popping out the other side, not far above the canyon floor. Just as I expected, Colin was already ahead of me. He'd found some backdoor route and had beaten me down, no doubt losing some skin in the process, his blood still hot with adrenaline. We slid and scratched through sharp-edged rocks, setting some rolling, kicking up dust for 10-20 feet. Toward the bottom, the rocks became boulders as big as washing machines. Below them were boulders the size of houses. We climbed cracks between them, descending into a canopy of sycamores. When we reached the bottom, daylight was nearly gone. We found the stream where we'd started and followed it, moving across beds of moss and broken tree stumps. With no more exposed rock, no more sudden falls, we walked with a lazy, exhausted stride, our feet painted in leaf dirt and blood. Sycamore trees sank into darkness as we felt our way along. We had headlights in our packs but didn't get them out. A last trace of light remained to show the way, a vaporous glow as if a modicum of daylight had not been able to find its way out of the canyon. A baby's cry lifted from the darkness ahead. It was a call of my son's hunger. It cried comfort, warmth, need, echoing among trees muted by leaves and trunks. Just as quickly, the voice was quieted. In the night beyond us, in a camp too far away for us to see, Jasper had been given whatever he needed. My body relaxed. I was almost home. And this concludes Ancient Creeks. Kendall Wright is the author of The Tales of One City, an article that appeared in the March 2009 issue of Arizona Highways. Tom Pitts is into stories, particularly those with a historical twist. That's why he's working to preserve Jerome one tale at a time. Every small town has its characters, and often those characters embody the quirkiness of the town. For Jerome, a 400-person hamlet that less than a century ago was home to copper mines that generated billions of dollars and attracted Wild West personalities in droves, the past has a huge impact on the present. Perhaps no one embodies that more than Tom Pitts, the owner of Belgian, Jenny's, Bordello, Bistro, and Pizzeria, and one of Jerome's most outspoken characters. A longtime radio personality and entrepreneur, Pitts, 67, has come to fill many roles in the town, most notably as storyteller extraordinaire. His favorite topic, Belgian Jenny, one of Jerome's wildest figures, and his restaurant's namesake. Our small town has attitude, that's for sure, Pitts says. We pride ourselves on attracting self-made people and respecting the individual, just like the old days. Those were the kinds of people that first made the town what it is, and I'm hoping my stories can help preserve that history. Although he's only lived in Jerome for about 3 years, Pitts has been in and out of the area for the past 5 decades, enough time to see some of Arizona's wonderful history disappear before his eyes. For a long time, people seemed to not care about old buildings or the stories, Pitts says. I'm so pleased that lately there seems to be a new energy to work toward and preserve our history. A similar energy and passion have motivated Pitts to work extensively with the Jerome Historical Society to get his mining museum in top shape. While doing research, Pitts came across information concerning one of his most famous story subjects, Jenny Bodders, a wealthy, well-educated, trilingual immigrant, more popularly known as Belgian Jenny, the town's most powerful madam. Jenny came here when Arizona was one of the only places women were allowed to vote, Pitts says. She was the one who put in the first concrete sidewalks and was paying for the construction of two-story buildings when other guys were still living in tents. She was smart and used that intelligence to make something for herself and her son. Pitts admits that his interest in Jenny's story stems from the fact that despite her place in history, he's become a kindred spirit of the Wild West heroine. She was definitely an independent and entrepreneurial individual with an energy I've tried to reflect in my own life. life, he says. Age is a state of mind. The learning process I've experienced in my research has been amazing, but more importantly, sharing what I learn is what's keeping me young. And this concludes The Tales of One City. Lauren Proper is the author of The Old Ballpark, an article that appeared in the May 2009 issue of Arizona Highways. Wrigley Field is old and Fenway Park is older. The oldest baseball stadium still in use, however, is in the small town of Bisbee, Arizona. The roof isn't retractable and it only seats 1,500 people, but Bisbee's Warren Ballpark holds the bragging rights to a record many larger, well-known, and historic stadiums wish they had. Baseball fanatics hardly ever put the diminutive stadium on their list of fields to visit, finding one way or another to disqualify it. They can't deny the facts, though. Warren Ballpark is the oldest baseball stadium still in use in the United States. Sorry, Red Sox fans, but Fenway takes the back seat. Warren Ballpark was built in 1909 by a subsidiary of the Calumet and Arizona Mining Company for $3,600 to provide recreation to miners and their families. The Bisbee team played its first game on June 27th that year and formed a semi-professional team that eventually became known as the Bisbee Copper Kings, which was recently revived as part of the Independent Arizona-Mexico League. One of the ballpark's more notorious historical happenings, however, had nothing to do with baseball. In June 1917, IWW union miners went on strike in Bisbee and Douglas over wages and mining safety concerns. On July 12th, after weeks of unrest, a large sheriff's posse forced almost 1,200 striking workers to march to the ballpark. Once there, those who refused to go back to work were loaded onto rail cars and sent to New Mexico. The next morning, the Bisbee Daily Review published a strongly worded article in support of what became known as the Bisbee Deportation, calling it the Great Wobbly Drive. The paper praised the action as a blow at traitors, spies, and anarchists that will make this click tremble everywhere west of the Rocky Mountains and hailed the nearly 3,000 vigilantes as heroes. It did take long for the games to resume, and for the next 9 decades, a wide variety of players entered the diamond in Bisbee. Teams ranging from the New York Yankees farm team to the Bisbee High School Pumas have called the ballpark home. Despite its rough patches, Warren Ballpark has weathered the past 10 decades and stands a testament to baseball history. It's something to brag about. And this concludes The Old Ballpark. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.